Diana Butler-Bass is someone that I know as pastors, you all probably know already, but for the benefit of students, I'll just introduce her with a few words. She's a scholar of religion and culture. She's been called one of Christianity's leading trend spotters. So here we are.
We're going to sponsor the program.
Y'all come on in.
Hey, Abby.
Hi.
Look, the front row is all available. This is like church. You know, if you come in late, then you have to sit on the front row. Sorry. This is where the energy is. You know, the data is clear. A recent study found that one out of three Americans under 30 respond that they are atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. And so that is sort of going to get our conversation started today. What does that mean for the church, for Christianity, for the culture at large? Diana Butler-Bass holds her PhD from Duke University. She's written 8 books. Her last book is called Christianity for the Rest of Us, How the Neighborhood Church is Transforming Faith, was named Book of the Year by the Academy of Parish Clergy for youth pastors. I'm sure that will be of interest to you. But her most recent book is called Christianity After Religion, The End of Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. And this book examines the connections and the divisions between theology and practice and community that Christians experience today. And the book is one which has been called prophetic, compelling, and most importantly, hopeful. And I think that this conversation today will give us all hope. It's easy, I know, to panic. But Dr. Bass is all over the place in the media. She has written for the New York Times Syndicate, for Time Magazine, USA Today, the Washington Post. She's a contributing editor at Sojourners Magazine. So she's really in touch with the culture. And I'm especially excited that students are here today. So we have real live examples for you to talk about. And feel free, there's coffee and tea in the kitchen. There is plenty of soup. Feel free, I know it's a little tight in here, but to get up and get whatever you like. And we'll just have time between now and 3 to hear from her and to hear from one another. So welcome.
Great. Thank you. Today what I wanted to do is talk about this book, Christianity After Religion, which was published in 2012. But not to go over it in such a way that I'm like reading the announcements. Instead, I want to tell you a little bit about myself and my academic background, why it is I do what I do, and take us to one slide out of a very long slideshow that will introduce the subject tonight of leaving church, where I'm going to be talking about young adults in America and what's really going on. But since I'm in a room full of experts, I'm feeling a little worried. I'm not a sociologist, and I can't figure out how I got to be called a trend spotter. My undergraduate degree was in social science, not sociology per se, and I took a social science degree because it was a way I could major in history, sociology, and political science without having to take statistics. I hated math, and so I did everything I could to avoid it. And my minor area was religious studies. And it was from that sort of mongrel undergraduate degree that I went off to seminary in the early 1980s just because I liked it. Without any plan on being a pastor, I thought maybe a little bit that I might want to become a missionary. But I just wanted to study theology and church history. And so I got a master's degree in church history. And while I was trying to figure out what am I going to do with this, one of my professors said to me, you know, you're actually very good at this academic stuff. Why don't you think about getting a PhD? And I thought, well, now there's something. Then I could teach, and my mom would not be so worried about me. I actually have a real job. So I wound up going to Duke University, getting a PhD in American religious history. Now, the reason I tell you all that is, for one thing, it's kind of encouraging for students. You know, you're walking the path, and you kind of think to yourself, what the heck am I doing, and how will this all come together? One of the things that's interesting is that it seems to come together. So you sort of keep on moving ahead and thinking about what the next step is. And it kind of works. And so for me, it worked. I became a college professor. I taught for 14 years. And then after that, my husband got a job in Washington, D.C. And there was no teaching position open. So I stepped out of traditional teaching, and we focused on me writing books. So that's what I am, really. I'm a historian who became a person who was working on my own, trying to figure out how to be a public voice of faith and following things that still interest me. About 10 years ago, I started writing about congregations because I realized that they are very important places of making social capital and of thinking about new ways of community forming. And also, I was very interested in the social justice aspects of the way in which congregations work. And it was from that that people began to press me and ask me questions. And this is the most sort of stunning question I think that I've ever been asked as a historian. And people start asking me, what do you think is going to happen in the future? I would say to people, I don't know. I said, I do not have a degree in soothsaying. I actually have a degree in 19th century American religious history. I can tell you what happened in the Second Great Awakening, but I'm not so sure I can tell you what happened in the future. But this is something that's really kind of odd about our culture, is that people who know history well are often pressed by other people to talk about the future. And so, while at first I kind of rejected the question and said, I have no clue, this historian decided that she would just kind of say, okay, maybe there are things that are true about the past that can help us to understand where we might be going in the future. And so that's when I actually really started paying attention to sociology and some other things that might help me think about what the future is. So I'm not a sociologist, I'm a historian. I always think of myself as writing a history for our own time, a history that will open up paths of meaning as we can make decisions together as communities to figure out what kind of future we want to make as citizens and Christians and people of faith in this great country. So that's kind of my work. Now, what I want to do with you all today is show you one picture, as I said, from this very long slideshow. So we'll be clicking past a whole bunch of stuff. And it's a picture of the future. And it's a picture that I show a lot to denominational executives and to pastors and bishops and all kinds of people who are already in church leadership. It is not a religious picture per se. It is a chart that I got from a political outfit. I first saw this chart on the Friday after the last general election. So this is a Friday after Barack Obama was elected president for a second time. This particular chart was part of a larger slideshow shown by a group called Public Religion Research Institute, which is a Washington, D.C. research and think tank. Actually, something else you can do with a religious studies degree is start a think tank in Washington, D.C. The guy who started Public Religion Research has a Ph.D. from Emory University, and he is an amazing, amazing fellow. He just turned 40. So anyway, Public Relations Research Institute is a great new startup think tank, and they're doing a lot of imaginative stuff. That Friday, after the general election, they held a press conference at the National Press Club, and the whole point of the thing was to help media from around the world understand the role religion had just played in the election a couple days before. And so we're going to just look for a moment at the blue and the red lines, and then I'll explain the other lines to you after I talk about the blue and the red. And you can see what they did with the blue and the red lines. The blue line is all Obama voters. That's the Obama coalition. The red line is a coalition of people who voted for Governor Romney. And then they took each one of these lines, these coalitions, and they broke them up into these traditional categories a sociologist of religion used to talk about religious identity in the United States. And when you look at the blue and the red, wow, you can really start seeing some amazing things. The Obama line, 25% of the people who voted for the president were religiously unaffiliated. And then you have all these orange colors here. And these orange colors represent, in a very real sense, the central kind of point of American religious history, the white Anglo hegemony of Protestants and Catholics that formed so much of America's identity, particularly in the 19th century and early 20th century. So you can see in these orange sections, 8% of the people who voted for the president were white evangelical Protestants, 13% were white mainline Protestants, so that would be Presbyterians, Lutherans, Episcopalians, Congregationalists, etc. 13% were white Catholics, 10% were Hispanic and other Catholic, and I always hate that, but that includes Asian Catholics, and the reason it just listed as other Catholics is it's very hard to drill down that deeply in a poll like this to pull out what the percentage of Asians, Asian Catholics are. But that's they're included in that group there. 16% were black Protestants, no surprise there. 9% of Obama voters were other Christians, and that would include Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, people who called themselves Christians but didn't further identify themselves as other Protestant or Catholic. And then 7% were non-Christian religious. And you can see the huge difference between the Obama voters and the Romney voters. Only 7% of people who voted for Governor Romney were religiously unaffiliated. And look at this, a whopping 40% of folks who voted for the governor were white evangelical Protestants. 17% were white mainliners, 18% white Catholics. And then you get out here into these green areas. I call this, the green section, racial and religious pluralism. And you see here, 2% were Hispanic and other Catholics. You might have heard a little discussion about this in the media.
I did.
It is actually, this chart is the day that discussion started. When this chart went up on the board of the National Press Club, there were not only reporters there, but there were also people who work in different congressional offices and think tanks in D.C. And when the picture was up, all of a sudden, all these people ran forward with their smartphones and took pictures of this and then texted it off to God only knows where, some congressman's office, saying, "What are we going to do about that?" So anyway, 2% were Hispanic or other Catholics. 1% were black Protestants. Every time I see that, I think to myself, what did those people say to their friends during coffee hour?
Very circumspect.
That's right.
They did not plan to what they need to say in
No conversation necessary. 12% were other Christians. I remember a moment ago I said that included Mormons. And then 3% are non-Christian religious. Well, that's a fascinating thing to just see about the elections. And being in a room in the National Press Club, of course, that's what nearly everybody was interested in Washington, D.C. Those, the red and the blue lines. Well, while everybody else was looking at the red and blue lines, I got fascinated by these lines. These lines, the non-colored sort of background lines, the ones that are just like ribbons through the page, are not lines about voters. These lines are just generational lines drawn out of a big survey that Pew Research did several years ago. So basically what you see in this picture is Public Religion Research's research of 1,400 people looking at that election and using as a contrasting point some research from Pew about the composition of each one of these successive generations of American adults. And so they wanted to, by putting these two things together, Public Religion was interested in drawing a picture of how old each one of these voting coalitions is according to religious views. And so you can see that the Obama coalition is falls somewhere in between 18 to 29 and 30 to 49 year olds in what it most resembles generationally. And I love looking at that 18 to 29 year old line. That's one of the things that I'm going to be talking about much more tonight. And that's what, of course, Karen was saying, that basically one out of every three, it's really a little higher, of people who are in their 20s is unaffiliated, 35%. And then you see this orange group of folks, 12% of young adults are white evangelical Protestants, 9% are white mainline Protestants, 5% are white Catholics. That is very small, especially compared to some of these other lines. 11% are Hispanic Catholics, and look at this, there are twice as many Hispanic and other nationality Catholics as there are white Catholics in this generational group. 11% are black Protestants, which is very interesting, that the African American community has sort of been holding its own among religious identity with young adults. 6% of young adults are other Christian. And look at this, a whopping 11%, almost one out, a little bit more than one out of every 10 of young adults between 18 and 29 is non-Christian religious. The Romney Coalition actually kind of moved off the chart in the comparison data. It most resembles the line of people who are 65 plus. You see here, adults who are 65 plus, which would include my deceased parents and my grandparents, and maybe your grandparents, I suspect your parents might be here. The 65 plus is, there might be somebody in the room who is in this group. 8% are unaffiliated. It's amazing. Less than 1 in 10. 28% were white evangelical Protestants. 19% are white mainline Protestants, 22% white Catholics, and then you get over here to the green, and that's a relatively compressed area, 6% Hispanic Catholics, 6% are black Protestants, 7% other kinds of Christians, and 4% non-Christian religious. This led public religion research to note that the average religious age of an Obama voter is 27, while the average age, religiously, of a Romney voter is 72.
But that wasn't a surprise, was it?
It was actually a surprise to the people in the room. It's the kind of thing where you might know it sort of in a very anecdotal way. But what this slide just showed, you know, in that room, was, oh my gosh, here's the data. And it was really surprising to the people who were gathered there. So, one of the things that it is Washington, it's a bubble. but here we have just a picture of the future. And now, of course, public religion was using this as a picture of the political future. But I was saying a moment ago that I got really interested in these other lines. And I very quickly realized when I was sitting in the room is that I was looking at a picture of a religious future as well as a political one. And so I began to show this slide to friends of mine who I said are church leaders and see what their responses are. The first interesting response is, wow, isn't that great? Can all these kids grow up and get to be 65 and go to church? Which, of course, is not what this slide means at all. I think that some of those people did not take sociology class at UVA. And so I have to patiently explain to church leaders that this is not a slide about how these people are going to mature into church, but that it's a completely different kind of slide. And then the second response that I have gotten, it came very early on when I showed it to a friend. I only had it for maybe a week. I showed it to a friend of mine who is an Episcopal bishop, and he looked at the slide, and he said, oh my gosh. He said, look at the orange people.
He said, that's like a trapezoid of despair.
And so here we have a church executive. And what does he hone in on? He hones in on the traditional sort of place, the constituency of most American churches. Those orange clusters in the middle. As we move into talking about this, I looked at him and I said, well, you know, that's really kind of interesting. Because the first thing I noticed when I saw this slide was not the orange. I said, the first thing that I was paying attention to was the beige and the green. And I said, I wasn't really thinking despair. I was thinking, wow, look at all those interesting theological possibilities for the future. And he kind of looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, maybe it's kind of like a theological Rorschach test. Mm-hmm. You know, what you look at first and where your imagination goes with this chart says an awful lot. About maybe what you do in the world or what you're responsible for in the world.
Mm-hmm. How you view the world.
And how you view
the world. Because you notice the rare, yes, old green folks were kind of consistent. We've been in the world that way a long time.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a really interesting picture, as I said, of the future. And I've begun to show it to people and ask folks what it stirs up. You know, in different groups in which I'm in. So at that point, that's what we want to do, is literally just open up our conversation and begin to talk about the picture. Yeah. Jamie, where are you from? Do you live in Charlotte?
Yes, I live in Charlottesville. Okay. I'm a member of Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church.
Okay. That's quite a name.
It is. TJMC. The 1829, how much has that changed over, say, the last 20 years? Because I know that that demographic typically isn't very engaged in church, but I'm not sure how much that's changed over time.
Well, see, that's actually one of the things that's kind of interesting about these other lines, is that if you talk about when the 30 to 49-year-olds were between 18 and
right.
29, or when the, and roughly, this is roughly millennials, roughly what we call Gen X, roughly baby boomers, and roughly silent generation and greatest generation people, to use that kind of language. So when Gen X or the baby boomers were in the young line, it was a while ago, one of the things that's kind of fascinating is that their lines were not all that terribly different.
Different
than they are now. Yeah, and so one of the things that I have actually asked the people of public religion research, and I have looked up this data myself, it comes from a lot of different sources, but the best analysis of the where the generations were when data comes from American Grace, Robert Putnam's book that came out in 2011, I believe. And he talks about when these other groups were younger. And one, like the baby boomers, you know, we always think about the baby boomers. They left church in droves, you know, they were all hot and bothered about the man, they, you know, went off and experimented with all kinds of stuff. At their highest point of becoming unaffiliated, it was 15% unaffiliated. And so they became more unaffiliated when they went to their 20s. And that doesn't mean that they all went to church, that everybody else, all the 85% over here, went to church or synagogue or mosque or whatever. But it does mean that they only popped up a little bit unaffiliated. Then when they got into their 30s and 40s and had kids and families, got married and had kids and families, then they became a little bit more affiliated. But the fascinating thing is this data now is from 2008, and everybody who does this data and is looking at these lines tells me that this number is about to go up. Mm-hmm. Because evidently we're about to see the phenomenon as baby boomers retire.
Yeah.
They're going back into kind of what you might call second adolescence. And boy, isn't that frightening. So that means some of you will be like, like watching out for your parents, make sure they don't drive when they're drunk. all the kinds of things that they've been telling you, you're going to get to tell them to do. So anyway, I hear that this number is popping back up, and so that they're actually becoming more unaffiliated as they now age into a different place. So what we see here, that 35% is going to be probably a relatively stable number.
Not increasing?
Well, it probably will increase for the next cohort that aren't on the board yet, because you're not allowed to do human research with people who are under 18. My daughter is 16, for example. I would be willing to bet that her group of friends is probably closer to 40% of people are unaffiliated.
Yeah. Did you describe unaffiliated?
Unaffiliated is an interesting cluster, Mariah. I'll get right to you. It's an interesting cluster of people. It includes everybody who says that they're atheist, agnostic, nothing in particular, spiritual but not religious, humanists, secularists. So this does not mean they all have the same point of view. And it also is just people who sort of have bailed out of here, these other categories, who are kind of floaters. And so the most, Chris Smith, who used to teach at Princeton, UNC, who's now at Notre Dame, he thinks that a certain amount of these people who are the floaters are going to pop back into some of these categories in a couple of years, but his guess is he's good as anybody's. So it's a very ragtag kind of group. And there's now beginning to be, anybody's looking for a topic for a bachelor's or master's or PhD thesis? Boy, this is one of the hot places of research in American religion right now. Mm-hmm.
Right. Where did the numbers come from? How many people were polled and how were they polled? Especially for the 18 to 29
years. Yeah, that's a great question. These lines, the four unshaded lines, come from a large Pew survey of 35,000 Americans. Yeah, this was one of the most sophisticated and broad-ranging surveys of American religious life ever done. And Pew was well aware by 2008 when the survey was done of the issue about communicating with younger adults. And so there were a whole bunch of methodologies employed that were new, not just standard phone surveys, using cell phones, internet surveys, different kinds of ways of connecting with young adults to try to get the best possible sample. Yeah, that's a really good question.
I'm just struck at the contrast in how you viewed this and the church official. You know, it's the church official going, oh my God, fear.
Yeah.
And you looking at it as an opportunity, which to me would be more of a going further, more of a aspect of love as opposed to fear. And then I would wonder, we are talking about Christian, the subject of Christ, how he would look at that.
Well,
he would look at it.
I, of course, would want it my position to be like Jesus.
But I'm struck that it's a church official that said it with fear.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to go to a psychology lecture after this on rethinking fear and Gilmer.
Oh, wow.
So.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting, too. Was there a question back there from one of the students? Yeah. Uh-huh. Or, no, you're not a student.
Not a student. I was just going to ask about the...
I saw some hands in the back.
Affiliated, I mean, would the older generations respond to a question saying, ascribing some affiliation in an actuality, they're not even sure, you know, not practicing any elements of life and faith. I'm looking at our population, not our church, maybe primarily 30 to 64, and I'd say it's between 17 and 13% of those folks were connected to churches. We wouldn't have enough seats in the churches for them. I don't, you know, I don't,
Yeah, this survey is literally just a survey of religious identity. And so that's what people are willing to call themselves when asked by a social scientist about their faith families. Mm-hmm. And so it says nothing about how good they are at it. And there are plenty of other kinds of studies that try to get at that. You know, what percentage of Jews really practice Judaism, or what percentage of Catholics really practice Catholicism. And so those are different studies. But this is interesting, because one of the things, even knowing that it's just religious identity, you can really just see this sort of generational softening in how people describe their lives of faith, and what sort of traditional labels they're willing to assume as helpful devices to explain their own journeys. And so you see that's decreasing as we go through time. So, yeah. Laura had her
I'll just want to, before some of the students leave, I'm just curious, from the student's point of view, when you look at that number and you think about your friends, do these numbers reflect your experience, like, at UVA, and how is that expressed? Or I'm just curious to know how you connect with that.
Yeah, I am too.
Okay. Actually, it was like, as a student, looking at the whole color section as a whole, and thinking that from the yellow, orange to the green, that whole chunk in itself is surprising to me. Mm-hmm. The amount of people that consider themselves religious. Because if I were to guess, I would guess that beige 35 would have been a lot more in my country. So regardless of race or what they're identifying with, mm-hmm. just the fact of, like, if this was just like a be like, are you religious or are you not, I would have thought that the beige is a lot bigger. But then again, that's in an academic university setting, which is very skewed from the rest of the 18 to 20 population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, actually, Mariah, when the bishop said that to me about the thing of despair, that actually frightened me, because if you put the orange and the green together, you still, that's a whole lot of people of faith, as you point out, and not even just people of faith. I mean, you don't have to go that generically. That is a whole lot of Christians still. But they are not the Christians that the institutions are typically looking at, because they come from other cultural settings and their skin color is different, so the institutions have been blind. And so it really helped to reveal the racism, and this is a smart, liberal, well-educated guy who said this, and he's on the front line, sort of lines of all kinds of great stuff for the poor, and yet he even said, look how small it is. Wait a second. As you point out, it's really a lot, it's really kind of still substantial, but it's more diverse in its cultural and ethnic and racial makeup, which is a great thing. And this guy's trying to get back here. Mm-hmm.
I was more interested in the unaffiliated group.
Mm-hmm.
When I first saw it, that was the scary part to me, because of the word unaffiliated, because to me that suggested apathy.
Yes.
So then when you were describing it, there was, that includes agnostics, atheists, spiritual but not religious people who have perhaps thought deeply about religion and come to some sort of conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering in what way this graph could interpret not caring about religion at all. Because it seems that each of these groups, except for maybe unaffiliated, that religion is very important in some way to America in general.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering.
I think you could actually make the argument, and this would be a great paper, that this group actually cares deeply, because what they're doing is that they have made considered choices to opt out of some of these labels, which for whatever reasons they find deficient or defective, and instead are saying, well, instead of taking a label that just doesn't work, I'm going to go over here. And these are the specific reasons why. And a lot of this is not what I would call slacker religion. And that is, unfortunately, for those of you who are like baby boomers and stuff, but that's a lot of what I hear from some of my baby boom colleagues. As soon as they see that, they say, oh, they have no ability to commit. And I'll say, that's a pretty big leap.
Yeah.
And so that's when I said a moment ago that that's kind of a territory that is ripe for great master's level PhD research, all those kinds of things. To really understand what's happening here is going to be a significant thing for scholars of religious studies and leaders of religious institutions in the future to be able to understand.
I would love to see the breakdown within that 35%. That's a pretty big number compared to, I mean, if you just add it up, like unaffiliated and then Christian, then like those would be comparable numbers. It might be like easier to swallow them.
Yeah, public religion research has done some analysis of the 35%. It's available online, and I think Pew has as well. And it's really pretty interesting. Of that group of people, it's only a small slice who are outright non-theists.
Mm-hmm.
So most are theists of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I was going to say, I started talking to someone about this last night, and what's interesting to me is that it's a more of a matter of people willing to have conversations, and so I feel like amongst my peers that it's people don't even want to talk about spirituality or faith in any way, and that's what scares me, is not necessarily that you're unaffiliated, but if I bring up God or Jesus or anything of that sense, people are like, oh, I don't want to have anything to deal with that, and I don't want... And that, to me, has been more and more prominent, and people come to their own conclusions of what they believe, but they don't... It can't be a discussion. And so I've noticed that is more and more... It's even the people that say that they may affiliate with those Protestant groups, for example, don't... That's because they grew up in that family environment, but they don't want to talk... It's not seen in their lifestyle, or that's not... They don't want to really talk about it at all, and that's just... So
do you think it creates the reluctance to want to have the conversation?
I would say the more individualized culture of today tells you it's okay to not believe anything and kind of do... You are director of your own path, and so it's like people don't want to ever admit that there's... A lot of people don't want to deal with the idea of there's something greater than them, and that they can kind of control it all their own, and that they think that people that do believe that are very stuck in their own...
Or stupid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Are very ignorant and are very conservative, and that's how they have kind of... I think the culture, our culture today, kind of portrays that image to them.
I've been asked on airplanes or, you know, places like, oh my gosh, you seem like you're a nice person. How is it that you can be a Christian?
Yeah.
Or like, how is it that you seem like, oh, my axe is hidden in my...
You seem like there. I had someone that told me that they were like, no, you're really fun. Like, you're fun to hang out with. You're a Christian, are you?
Well, it's really interesting. It talks about... I actually think that what I'm going to talk about tonight is how this data actually leads us right into the struggle of the public narrative of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And you just did that right there. Heidi, you want to go ahead?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't mean to knock home with some of the pastors.
To your point, I think that I've really noticed that if Christianity has sort of become a taboo subject among my peers and I, even though, especially I see it in my sorority, which was founded on Christian ideals a few hundred years ago, but still the fact that in our weekly meetings there is still a Christian presence, but in the day-to-day interactions, speaking of Christianity is taboo, whereas there are a few Jewish girls in the sorority that are very open about their Jewish activities and fundraisers, and nobody thinks anything of that, but as soon as some of the Christian girls start talking about our events that are coming up, it's sort of like, oh, you're judging us, or there are so many more implications.
Mm-hmm.
When talking about Christianity.
Wow, that's really interesting. Go ahead,
I would say that I think America still has a different view. We've had, I just read The Holocaust Ministry, which has, how Americans right now have a particular view of Jewish people post, 1970 and, the creation of Israel, and just the fact that, they are also, it's more of, ethnicity as well, so that's something that it's, if you're claiming Judaism, it's also, claiming ethnic, so it's then at that point, it's almost like a racist thing.
Yeah.
You know? Like, oh, you know, like, well, so I think that it's a lot more complicated, specifically with,
Judaism than just like a different religion. But I do think that that is like true. Like Christianity, I think a lot of people jump at, like, oh, you're judging us.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think it might have something to do with, I mean, as soon as I hear all these comments, one of the things that comes to my mind is that if you just look at these kinds of generational lines, you're talking about the majority culture. You know, you're talking about a culture that had a sustained, long, loud, powerful voice over a lot of American history.
Yeah.
And what's happened here, and you can see it so clearly in this diagram, is that there is this shift. I don't necessarily call it a trapezoid of despair, but what you do see up here with all these different colors is you see that's genuine pluralism.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you move from a position where you had a culture with a large kind of homogeneous center, or at least a center that pretended it was homogeneous enough to maintain power over a long period of time, when you have that kind of cultural center, and then it moves into a position where it's actually a minority, that in some ways the rest of the culture is going to respond to that. You people were in charge for a long time. Now it's our turn to talk, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a lot of misapprehensions about power and privilege and all kinds of stuff that go on in a picture like this.
Yeah.
So just to jump off that, you might be talking about this later tonight, but you mentioned the excitement over new theological possibilities just coming from that diversity of the orange to green.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think those are? And what will these new, kind of the diversity of perspectives and prominent voices within the Christian tradition today, rather than kind of the dominant white Anglo-Saxon Protestant majority of the past, what does that change for the future? What are those possibilities kind of moving forward of having those other voices?
Oh, my gosh. My most exciting possibility actually comes off of a picture that's not on the board. It just is something that I'm sure that a lot of us know. If you study news events or what's going on, particularly in the rest of what used to be called Christendom in Europe. If we had a line here of young adults in Europe of the same age, what it would be like is there would be a lot more people who would be unaffiliated, and then probably a lot more of the green lines of this of diversity, and a much thinner slice of the sort of the traditional European, basically white cultural church groups. And so what you see when you go over to Europe right now is that there's actually a huge fight between secularism and sort of all of this plethora of racial and ethnic and religious diversity, some of which is very fundamentalist and very radicalized. And what you have in Europe is you have a fight between this highly secularized, unaffiliated, post-Christian, non-theist kind of culture, and a sort of a tradition, at its best, a traditional kind of cultural immigrant that comes from, say, Africa, that's not a radicalized person, but is a person who comes from a more traditional kind of culture in Africa or South Asia or someplace. But then you have all the radicalized elements of that, and you have nothing really in the middle, navigating between the two things.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, if we think about your younger adults as a generation, this is actually fairly balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that Christianity and these more traditional, or these what I reach here into the black community and parts of the Hispanic Catholic community, these groups here have a whole different kind of what I would call social stake in creating a theology that actually can be beneficial in making the common good, in drawing together people who are unaffiliated or people who are post-religious, and people who come from these other kinds of more radical extreme groups. And so here becomes a whole new project for American theology, being really not the center, but a conversation conduit in which people who are at war in Europe maybe can talk to one another here and make a different kind of theological future for Western Christendom, or Western post-Christendom, whatever you call it. Mm-hmm. So that's my where my imagination goes. Mm-hmm. But other people's imagination is going to go to other places.
When I look at this chart, you were asking about reactions. My reaction is, does this indicate that the future of Christianity is going to involve a revival of the monastic tradition? And the reason I say that is because in medieval Europe, it was the monasteries as tightly committed communities that did the job of Christian formation and of evangelism. And in the future, are we going to need committed communities that are the cutting edge for the Christian mission out in the world of the unaffiliated?
Well, I've seen that suggested by everyone from Alistair MacIntyre, the high-level philosopher, to Ross Douthat, the columnist for the New York Times, and a lot of places in between, saying that we need a new St. Francis or a new Benedict or whatever. And is there any neo-monastic kind of communities here in because a lot of university towns are actually have them. And my goddaughter is actually married to a guy who's a significant person in the neo-monastic kind of young communities movement in the United States. So I know a lot about them. I think that's part of it. But what I really want to see, and this is for the church leaders, I don't want you to slough off your responsibility for being great communities of formation and commitment and say, oh, well, there'll be some monastery that pops up that can do that. Basically, what you just outlined is actually a call to congregations. Because what happens in a picture like this is the old sort of comfortable cultural congregation becomes less and less a possibility.
Yeah.
And what has to happen is that congregations themselves have to take on greater levels of commitment and clarity in order to be, just even navigate this as a cultural reality.
Yes, ma'am. I was just curious on your 18 to 29 figures, what of the unaffiliated, is there a breakdown of the ethnicity of that?
In other places. But not here. One of the things that I do know about that line is that it depends on what part of it you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, say, the spiritual but not religious, the vast majority of people who call themselves who would be in that category, that age group, would be white. One of the most interesting things, though, that I think I've seen in recent years is that atheism is not ethnically or racially distinctive. Mm-hmm. Is that you do have considerable numbers of Hispanic, particularly Hispanic immigrants, who are peeling off into the atheist subcategory of the unaffiliated. And you have a lot of African Americans over there, too. So we're talking about the big sorts of ethnic groups in the United States. And also, I would think you have a lot of people from South Asia, probably, are in that category, as maybe non-theists. Or also, we're in the heck. If you're not a Hindu, but you kind of carry some of the cultural stuff of Hinduism, where would you put yourself on this chart? Mm-hmm. I mean, where do people who are sort of polytheists go? Or people who are from multiple religious marriages? Mm-hmm. Like across the street from my house, there's a Jew who's married to a Hindu. And what are their kids? They're Hindu Jews.
Jindus.
So, they're going to go over there. And so that, in a sense, when you start talking about multiple religious identity, you're also going to get a lot of persons of color and a lot of ethnic diversity. So mostly the spiritual but not religious are primarily white, but those other categories are surprisingly multi-hued.
The chart is really well named, The End of a White Christian Strategy.
Yes, isn't that amazing?
And even as we talk about it, I think it's three things that are very important. Y'all don't get to call the shots anymore.
Yeah.
Y'all don't get to talk about us in the room, and we don't get to say anything. Not anymore. I'm so sorry. And I'm real happy about that. The other thing is that it's so funny because actually the demographics have been showing that this is going to come. Why are we so surprised? We already knew that by a certain date, Anglo-Americans were not going to be the majority culture in this country. And all this fear mongering that we see now is people trying to hold on to power that's already lost.
Right.
And so part of my understanding of what my calling is to do is number one, how to have a cogent conversation with people who are not so freaked out, scared, that they're willing to do anything in the name of Jesus, including kill me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the third thing. The other thing is, but it's been a long time. When I was at Vanderbilt, there was a man, I can't remember his name, bless his heart, who was trying to write a systematic ecology, which is so stupid. You can't write a systematic theology of the world anymore.
It's going to have to be really different.
You can't do
What's
it.
What's systematic about
yeah.
this?
You don't have enough people who buy into the notion to even make it worth your while, especially not to be your life's work. What we're talking about is, like Octavia Butler, like a science fiction writer, her works are very prophetic because she talks about a world that has divided into its sections because we can't figure out how to work together. And it's unworkable. It's crazy. As Christians, we've got to figure out how to make this thing work. And that means everybody has to be at the table. You don't have enough power to keep me from the table anymore. And I don't know if you've noticed, but everybody, cultures where folks have been oppressed, the people who are oppressing have been driven by the fear that the people they are oppressing are going to rise up and kill them in their bed. Mm-hmm. We know enough about Jesus that if we were going to do that, y'all be dead. We don't do that because it doesn't work.
Tried that one a couple times. it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
And to me, you know, actually, Brenda, thank you so much. I mean, that's part of the excitement of this picture,
mm-hmm.
you know. And when I saw it, I thought to myself, oh, my gosh, it's sort of the promise of, you know, if we think about it politically,
it's
sort
kingdom.
Of the promise of America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
you know,
on top of that, the kingdom.
Right. And then secondarily, the theological mm-hmm. promise is the promise of the Book of Acts. And so... So that becomes a pretty exciting thing. And I think that you and Riley are actually saying something that's really kind of similar.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, he asked, well, what kind of theology?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't actually know what the shape of that theology is, but notice how I wrote that theology. Look at how I did that with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be something about crossing boundaries.
Yes.
It's going to be about creating different kinds of conversations. It's about weaving things together in new ways. So I didn't write it. I didn't do it. Sometimes I've seen people who teach theology say a theology.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
No. Mm-hmm.
But it's different. And so that to me is one of the things that one suggests. So yeah. And this picture here, I do think, if you understand that, you understand tons about what's going on in our news cycles every day. And it helps me in that way. I get excited. The other piece I get excited about with this picture is, look at this. You, Brenda said this, is that, well, we've known that this is coming for a long time. We're still not yet to racial and ethnic pluralism that is supposed to be 2025 or 2030, so
mm-hmm.
it's still a little bit off in
mm-hmm.
the future.
Yeah.
But we have already arrived at it through the experience of American religion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So people always say that religion is behind, but look at this picture here.
Mm-hmm.
Religious life in America is already plural.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in reality, and this happened, the shift towards genuine pluralism happened in 2012. So, if indeed we already live in a pluralistic religious culture, that means religion is ahead
mm-hmm.
by some 15 to 20 years
mm-hmm.
of where the rest of culture will be.
Long last.
Mm-hmm. So there it becomes another point of theological reflection.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean? To live there, and how does a kind of religious pluralism, how might it contribute to the construction of social pluralism and meaningful identity and meaningful community?
Mm-hmm.
So theology can lead the way here
mm-hmm.
rather than falling behind. It's just like, wow, imagine
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Laura, you've been really trying to jump in.
Well, what's good is that my question was sort of, my first question was answered, which was to ask you to unpack the hopeful attitude that you had, because I'm a little bit like the bishop, and then
I'm sorry.
I wasn't quite despairing, because I live in that world. I'm a campus minister, so I know that 35. I know that that's true. So my follow-up question is, and maybe you're going to touch on this tonight, is how those of us still involved in institutional religion can both help those institutions adapt and perhaps die, if that's what needs to happen, or maybe you don't think that that's going to happen, but just a little bit more from you, if it's not preempting tonight, about what institutional, those squishing orange line folks, or at least white traditional power players, could do to help this situation and to bring us forward.
Yeah, you know, that's probably, in addition to people asking me to tell the future, the second question I get asked the most is, what in the world should we do about it, in terms of our institutions?
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I actually think we need to do is slow down thinking about the institutional question, is because institutions, at their best, arise out of meaning and relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And until we have genuine friendship, real people listening to one another across these lines, some understanding of what's going on. And it goes everything from understanding, like, I think this is really an interesting conversation that Heidi and Peyton brought up about, there's actually a misunderstanding about what Christianity is in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with a lot of these kinds of dynamics, and it plays itself out in some interesting ways. But then there's the misunderstanding that Brenda's pointing out, too, is the huge sort of problems that have arisen from white people having control for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we start talking immediately about institutions, it becomes about what our institutional sort of life has been for the last 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's been issues of structuring, kinds of affirmative action kinds of things, which I actually am in favor of, and it makes a lot of sense. But that then, when that becomes the primary way we think of institutions as programs that we can sort of put in different chairs and put different people on the chairs, and then the problem is fixed, that's not really what a good structure or a good institution does.
I agree.
Yeah.
And that wasn't really what my question was.
So
I guess it's...
I guess my answer is, I don't know.
It's a lofty question, but these are all lofty questions that I like exploring.
It is a university.
Yeah.
It is.
And so I wasn't putting forward, let's maintain the structure and therefore everything will be solved. That's not at all what I was asking. I was asking, given the changes that are going on, these previous power players, how, and you hinted at it in the conversation of perhaps they can be conduits where they used to be at the center, now they can be kind of conduits. And I guess, I just was looking for a little more playing around with what that might look like. And, you know, because the benefit is we have had the resources to pay staff that then do things because the institution can perpetuate itself.
Actually, there is one thing I can share
with
you about institutions. One of the other groups of people I showed this to was a group of friends of mine who are all really, really rich. And they run all these sorts of hedge funds, and they, you know, they go to Wall Street. They think that's just lunch, you know. And so I showed this to this group of serious, big-time investors, bankers, Wall Street guys. And I said, what do you think about this? I said, if we were a group of hedge fund managers, and you're looking at a chart like this about investment, what do you think?
And they said, well, we never put any money there.
That's right.
they
actually said, this is a kind of chart that they actually see.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they, and this is a stretch for me, who doesn't like numbers, but I appreciate what they were saying, is they said this constitutes, the beige and the green constitutes what they call emerging markets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And said, so they said smart business people spend a lot of time thinking about emerging markets.
Mm-hmm.
And what can learn from emerging markets, what needs emerging markets have, how you invest in emerging markets to leverage the maximum amount of profit and all that kind of stuff. And they said, you know, you do have to kind of keep some level of your portfolio in the traditional self. Yeah, you know, and so that when these emerging markets go too wild, you know, you can invest in kind of the wrong thing. There's a sort of a stable center. They said, but really, really, you don't want to spend most of your institutional time, energy, and resources
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
You want to spend most of it thinking about this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, would you be willing to go with me and talk to
no, like the World Council of Churches?
Exactly. And they said, wow, that's an interesting idea. So, but anyhow,
they even prayed over it.
Yeah. But it is an interesting kind of angle onto the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, what I do know is so many, I'm Episcopalian, oh my gosh, we spend huge amounts of money, time, and energy concentrated on the tiniest little slice
mm-hmm.
of that 9% right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to myself, oh my goodness gracious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if we were spending that money in other places?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of to me, you have to think of, maybe we can think about this differently.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I would put a lot of my money in would be college chaplaincy.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes you feel
yay!
Good. No, actually, that I think, if any religious institution that doesn't have a lot of its money invested in the
mm-hmm.
places where young adults actually are,
mm-hmm.
is stupid.
Really?
Please repeat that in every
grade. I do. They don't listen.
Maybe one day they'll get it. Yes, go ahead, Brenda.
It's so funny because ideas keep going around and they lose cachet, but they really make sense if we go back and look. I remember reading Gandhi's autobiography, and he talked about institutions and that they arise because there's a need. And when the need is met, then the institution either has to sit itself down or evolve to the next need.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened, and that shows it a lot, is that we have gotten so institution-bound that a lot of these institutions should have died a long time ago. But we make money off of it. It's like cancer research. Come on, y'all. All that money. What incentive is there really to find a cure to cancer when you can make so much money looking for it?
Well, it's an interesting question of power and the way
mm-hmm.
in which money and power are connected. So, yeah. Other comments? Yes. You both had your hands up at the same time. Let me go ahead.
Well, it just makes me think of that as far as you said where to put your money and stuff, but it's also a matter of the formal institutionalized religion isn't working anymore.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. you have, once you meet that reality, that's where you have to come, like you said, come to the table, have discussions, and have respect for other thought, and work together for, you know, it's almost like, let's all come together, kumbaya thing, you know,
come
whatever
come
you are from, what religion or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, because I think it, you know, at the basis of most religion is to help others,
mm-hmm.
to improve, you know, lives. And I think that's a fundamental agreement of many religions. I'm not saying all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think as far as impacting people,
yeah.
that's where you, that's kind of where you need to go in order to make that difference.
You know, one of the things that you said makes me, I think, of a great example of something that's happening this weekend. You know, how in the world, if you don't go the affirmative action sort of structural approach, what are some of the ways in which, say, this old sort of power center, which is now much declined, can really reach out here and understand and be friends with and form new relationships and listen to people? Well, you know, you just suggested some things, but one of the things that I am fascinated by is I grew up Methodist, became an Episcopalian, and my family is all background, German, with a little bit of English and Scottish in it. So, you know, Anglo-Aryan, you know, that's just, I like represent this. And I have to carry that with me. And I carry that whole history with me. And when I was a little girl growing up, we had Halloween on October 31st. Well, one of the things that happened over my lifetime
and this began to happen when I was little, is that Protestants and Catholics started talking more. And that wasn't the case when my mom was a little girl. My mom still tells the stories. She would be 74 if she was still alive. She still tells the story of how she could not be the maid of honor in her best friend's wedding because my mom was a Methodist and her best friend was Catholic. And so she couldn't even be a bridesmaid in the wedding. So from my mom's generation to my generation, this weekend changed when Protestants began celebrating All Saints Day. Most Protestant churches I know that are sort of mainstream Protestant churches, not evangelical churches necessarily, but even there I've seen this happen. Celebrate now Lutherans, Presbyterians, Congregationalists. I've even seen Unitarians talk about All Saints Day. And so there's been a different kind of conversation as the sort of shifting relationships happen between Protestants and Catholics. Well, this week I'm looking at Facebook, and nearly all of my friends out in Arizona, Colorado, California, Wyoming, all those places, everything west kind of that big river that divides the United States in half. I don't know what that would be called.
Mississippi.
Well, no, I was going to say it's probably a lot further east. It's like the Ohio River here in Virginia. It's like it's hard to get past the East Coast, the Appalachian Mountains. But you go over there, and lo and behold, all of my friends on Facebook have up pictures of the Day of the Dead. It's like I was looking at the All Saints Pasadena, biggest Episcopal church in the United States, 8,000 people. And there's a photograph on the pastor's front page of her Facebook page that is the altar, and it's full of skulls. These are Episcopalians in Pasadena, California, which is the whitest place in all of Southern California, which is the old Anglo-establishment part of California. It's Pasadena and Berkeley, those two places. Mm-hmm. And so here they are in the richest, biggest Episcopal church, and they're celebrating Halloween, All Saints Day, and Day of the Dead. Mm-hmm. Now, what that sort of shoots me towards is part of what's happening here is becoming friends, telling stories, learning to listen better, but also that our practices, our ways of really beginning to start different kinds of structures and institutional kinds of changes. As Anglo-white people understand what the Day of the Dead is about, all of a sudden, there's a different dimension to the liturgies of this particular weekend that begin to emerge. Very experiential ones, ones that remind us of the thinness of the reality, of what we have seen as a bifurcated reality between the living and the dead, that these things are actually much more interwoven, and that our Hispanic friends have reminded us of this by introducing into our communities a practice, and that practice can now be celebrated and shared, even in a place like Pasadena, California. So that, you know, it's even a little bit more than we're all alike. It's actually that we're all different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that in that difference, we're learning, sometimes even when we don't try very hard, to appreciate and receive the wisdom that the other group bears through beautiful practices that we can share in faith community. And so, so that to me, this whole weekend to me is really interesting because it's so different than it was in the early 1960s. It's remarkable how different it is. Yes, ma'am. That's it.
So it seems like we've been talking that the dialogue has sort of been increasing within our generation, within the sort of 18 to 29-year-old, and that is sort of accounting for this change within the millennials. But I guess my question would be, why is this kind of dialogue not happening from these statistics, it looks like, between the generation? Because the biggest jump is from the 30 to 49-year-olds to the 18 to 29-year-olds. I mean, it's an almost 20% change in the unaffiliated, and that's just surprising to me.
Yeah, you know, thanks for pointing it out, because I actually think that this is one of the...
I hear baby boomers sort of wax eloquent about being able to deal with pluralism, but they can't deal with the pluralism that's at their dining room table when their kids come home from college.
And so, so I would love to see that change. And however we can make that change, I think that the future is dependent on us being able to talk about that better between generations and really be able to learn from one another. Thank you for pointing it out. And part of the reason for the jump, do we have any sociology majors here? Okay,
sociology major.
Part of the reason for the jump is you might notice this. One of the things that's happening over here that I think is kind of fascinating, people don't talk about very often, is what we call birthright affiliation. And so the idea of disaffiliating with religion or having a none of the above answer, it actually started in the early part of the 20th century. Mostly in the 1920s, as people just sort of, there were people who stepped out and said, you know, no more religion for me. And those people were a minority group, especially some of them were very militantly atheist. And then through the 1950s, they didn't often like to talk about it because you get called a communist if you didn't belong to church or if you didn't believe in God. But those people sort of were quietly forming their own sort of cultures and structures on the edge of mainstream culture. And they married one another, and then they had kids, and they raised those kids as unaffiliated. And then those kids had grew up and married other unaffiliated people and had kids. 25% of this group up here were born unaffiliated. So one out of every four people who is in that group there is birthright. And so what you see there is demographics as destiny. And so that's one of the reasons you get a big burst between here and here. And that's what happens with demographics. It moves slowly at first, but then all of a sudden it becomes obvious. And that's what's happened with your age group. Yeah, it's got to be obvious. So I bet you kind of know, do you know some people like that? Who just never have been to church or synagogue or mosque.
And I know some who are swimming upstream the other way, that every once in a while I come across a student whose parents have no religious background.
And they want to go.
And I have such respect for that swimming upstream in a different way.
It's a really interesting question. Yes, ma'am. Elena. Is that what you said?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Just talking about the generation, the birth rate of religion, kind of, why do you think it's so much more prominent for unaffiliated than it is for any of the white religions or anything like that? I'm just curious to know, because it seems like it would be consistent, but yet it doesn't appear that it is.
Well, I think that part of the issue that happened here is that each one of these different successive groups experienced birth rate declines. Mm-hmm. And so while this group started small and was quietly kind of intermarrying and quietly having families, they were starting from basically nothing. And so then you get and not all these 35%, remember, just probably about a quarter of those people are born that way.
Okay.
So that becomes moving from nothing to having a significant presence. Whereas these groups all had significant birth rate declines. Why do you think the Roman Catholic Church is so worried about birth control? Look at this. 22% of the population used to be white Catholic, 65+. Then 19%, not that huge of big of a drop, but then the pill gets introduced right in the middle of this group's life experience right in here, and then it goes down to 15%. Look at what happens here. Oh my gosh. Big mistake. That's what you call a market crash. Right there. And the other market crash is over here with evangelicals. That's a major league freak out over here. I was with a group called the Protestant Church Owned Publishing Association in April, and I showed them this chart. And it used to be that the Protestant Church Owned Publishing Association was mostly Lutherans and Presbyterians and very brand name kinds of religious groups. And now it's about 2/3 evangelicals, so it's Baptist Press or Pentecostal, this and that, the Grow Your Arms Up in the Air video. And it was just an amazing group of diverse people from evangelicalism. And they were all there in the room. And the first thing they said when they saw this chart was this: the 29% that they had with the baby boomers
to the 12% that they have with this group here. And that's all they want to talk about. Is that shift right there.
Yeah, it seems like the Hispanics and African Americans are doing something right, because they go from 3% in 30 to 49 and 8% to 11%.
Well, I think that this is a really, you know, it's an interesting thing, is that the percentage of people, this one is fascinating because the African American percentage of the population in African American churches has ebbed and flowed a little bit through the 20th century. But they're doing, here it is, sorry about that, the second green one. They're doing actually pretty well, and the number is fairly close to the percentage of people who are actually black in the population. And so that makes me wonder if your kinds of questions aren't a little bit sort of in line here, what you were saying about racial identity and religious identity. It still might be a little bit more closely defined for black Protestants than it is for white Protestants. So, you know, what does it mean to leave the black church? Well, people do.
Trust me, they do.
But there is an identity piece there that people hold on to maybe a little longer.
And on the other flip, when I first got back, this is my hometown, I've been going quite a while, and I'd come back and do workshops, and I remember doing a diversity workshop at the library. And we were talking about racial initiatives, because we're always talking about race something in this. We talk it to death in this town. But what's
it's
really,
Virginia.
Yeah.
We love talking about
in the shadow of TJ. But what's very interesting, and you could see it a while ago, is that I had grandmothers in the audience who had half black grandbabies. And I said, we can't talk about race and ethnicity in the same way anymore, because our babies, our children's children, are now what we used to think of as other. Mm-hmm. Whole conversation changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think also plays into this.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you call yourself? Canada has moved, or is moving, towards having a box on the survey forms that say I'm multi-religious.
Yeah.
And so now in the United States we can actually check into biracial or multiracial as racial preference. Canada's moving to put in one for religious preference as bi-religious or multi-religious. I'm really interested in seeing when they do their next set of surveys, what percentage of Canadians will come up and say that they're multi-religious.
Could you talk a little bit about the whole spiritual but not religious trend? You'll probably talk about it tonight, but just for those of us in the room, because this is something we hear a lot, like, what do you think that's about? What's behind it? Or what are people saying when they say that?
I hate church.
That's one of the things they're saying.
Or what are they asking to, and what are they wanting to engage? What kind of conversation?
Well, you know, I actually love the language when people talk about being spiritual or spiritual but not religious, or spiritual and religious. A bunch of the slides that are lower down the slideshow have to do with that very question. Basically, it's kind of this. The language around the words spiritual and religious has changed a lot in the last 30 years. And the word that we used to use, religion, used to be a generally positive term. I tell this to some people now, and they go, you're kidding. My daughter, she says, really? And so that used to be a generally positive term that meant that, you know, you went to church, you went to synagogue, you believed in God, you know, you were a good American. Mm-hmm. To say you were religious meant something about your political and patriotic loyalties. And so you were religious. And spiritual, or spirituality, used to mean alternative. Mm-hmm. So it used to mean New Age, sort of religion on the edge, you know, Mary Baker Grady, Christian Science. It meant a lot of things like New Thought. It meant those kinds of things. In the last 30 years, mostly since the 1960s, and this comes from psychology of religion, so this is way far out of my field. I talked to a friend of mine, and he helped me understand these shifts.
psychology religionist is studying this, is that religion has increasingly become identified, that word now means institution or organization. So it means a structure of faith that is external to one's own experience. It has authority that's external and all that kind of stuff. Whereas spiritual, and that's a big shift from meaning I believe in God and I go to church and I'm a good American to meaning structure or organized faith. And then spirituality changed from New Thought or New Age to meaning experience. Okay. It's that basically when people say they're spiritual, they're talking a language of connection, personal connection, or personal experience related to God or meaning or wonder or all. And so these two words have become very different. I'm really aware that my colleague Mark, who's also a church historian, is in the room. So I have to say this so he knows I know what I'm talking about. Is that this has happened in other times in church history, mm-hmm. where the idea of form separates from the animating sort of content of faith. And people call that different things at different times in church history, but for whatever reason, this is one of those times in which people make clear, whether they should or not, they nevertheless do, they make clear distinctions between form and spirit. And people refer to those things as religion and spirituality. Now, classical Christians are kind of stuck in this, you know, sort of thing. Well, what does this mean for us? You know, we're kind of religious. You know, we go to church. But I think we need to be aware of how deeply the language has changed. And basically, when you are sitting on that airplane, you know, I was saying, you know, the axe murderer thing, you know, my axe is in my suitcase. And I actually now say on airplane, people ask me, what do you do? And I say, well, I write books. That's the first thing I say. And then they say, oh, that's big. What kind? And I say, nonfiction. And what I've learned over the years is that if they push the genre further, the best thing to say is I write about religion and spirituality in America. And then what I do is I let the person sitting next to me on the plane, I let them take the conversation. I have never had a person on the plane say, oh, religion, I love it. I've never had that response. I fly 100,000 miles a year. No one has ever said that to me. Instead, the answer, you know, 90%, sometimes I'll get a, oh, I'm an atheist. And I have gotten that. That's very interesting. But most of the time, somebody will say to me, well, I was religious when I was growing up, but now I'm more of a spiritual person. And I'll say, well, what do you mean by that? And one of the things that's kind of interesting is that they usually mean by it what people used to mean by religion. But they don't talk about that. Like, oh, I go to church once in a while. That was my parents. They would have said they were religious. They went to church about maybe once every 3 months. You know? We kind of romanticize what used to be the case. But what counted as religion in the 1950s is that, you know, sort of Eisenhower, soft. I was a Methodist. Show up to church a couple times a year. Now, my parents would probably answer the question now, well, we're spiritual people and we go to church once in a while. And so it would be a different answer because the language has changed. So that's basically the way in which the majority of people in North America and English-speaking cultures use that language now. Doesn't mean everybody does, but for the most part. When people ask me, I say I'm spiritual and religious. That's fun. Because then they say, how do you put that together? Oh, and I go, oh, geez, it's really hard. And then they want to know. Well, you know, and so then that opens up a different kind of conversation with folks.
I think that's a great question. Actually,
I have a slide someplace on
further down in my slideshow on that. I don't know where I put my clipper.
Over there.
And Abby here, she got her hands up. She took a class on spiritual, but not religious.
Oh, yeah, actually, both of us did. We just took it last semester.
Oh, my gosh.
It was not spiritual, but not religious. And we read your book, Christianity After Religion.
Oh, my.
So I was going to ask you to speak a little about that book and kind of what you say in there.
check out the church's response to that.
Oh, well, see, here's a chart from the middle part of the book.
Yeah.
Perfect. and that's really where I will oftentimes spend almost a day or two with church leaders on this stuff right here. And I found this to be fascinating. I looked at that 10-year spread just at the end of the 20th century and then the end of the first decade of the 21st century. And you can really see the linguistic change here, the change in attitude. Is that when about 30% of people say they're spiritual but not religious, and this is not nearly as sophisticated as the last chart I'm showing you. This is a more of a newsweek kind of poll. 30% of people say they're spiritual but not religious, and that number has stayed the same. Since we're in ACC country, you can tell that this is Chapel Hill blue and that's Duke blue.
20, 40, 60?
That's just percentage? Oh, yeah, this is the percentage. So, okay. See, that's 30%. And look, that didn't change at all from the end of the 20th century in the first 10 years of the 21st. And then you go down here to the neither number, and that's 9%, and that stayed the same for the first 10 years of the 21st century. Look at this huge switch in the middle. Mm-hmm. And I think that this mostly has to do with shifting definitions. Mm-hmm. Is that at the end of the 20th century, still as late as 1999, 54% of Americans would call themselves religious but not spiritual.
Which I can't still figure out why they're not.
Yeah, right. But my father-in-law, he just passed away, he was 89, and I asked him one time, I gave this little quiz, and he said, well, I don't know what I am. And he goes, I'm a Presbyterian. And then he went on and he said, I've been a Presbyterian my entire adult life. That's a religion and there's nothing spiritual about it. And so that's kind of a 20th century way of thinking about this question, I think. And look at how small a percentage of people, you know, now will say they're religious but not spiritual. That's 9%. 54 to 9% in just 10 years for the first part of the 21st century. And then you go the 6% here of people who said at the end of the 20th century they're spiritual and religious, and now that's one out of every two. That's half. And so this is the kind of question that I really sort of dive into with religious leaders, is saying, okay, well, what does that really mean? You know, for being church, for being synagogue, for being a community of faith of any sort, what does it mean? And people come up with lots of different answers. I don't know that anybody's got the book written on that yet. But it's kind of fun. There's a picture of religion. There's a decaying church. There's the classic spiritual picture. This is a great study. I thought this was a fact. Did you read this study? This just came out.
Yeah, we took the class last semester.
Oh, yeah, so you wouldn't have had access to it. This came out in the spring. It's a really good study by Hal Fisher and Chavez, or Chaves. I never know how to pronounce his last name. And then this is the thesis of it. The historic distancing of Americans from organized religion continues to evolve. More Americans than ever profess having no religious preference. And their quarrel appears to be with organized religion. That's what Brenda was saying. Mm-hmm. And so we're getting the anti-church phenomenon, which has been part of European Canadian culture for a long time. And so, here's a picture of beginning to think about, well, what does it look like to put those things back together? And so here's a historic, gothic, church. That's in California. And outside, there's a labyrinth, a different kind of invitation to a spiritual path. And bringing those together in Christian community is something you see. There are lots of churches doing these kinds of things. So anyway, that's a part of the... I loved this. I guess we're getting towards the end. Yeah. I just took this picture.
Is it Riverside?
This is Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. How many people, has anybody ever been there? Okay, a few of you. Grace Cathedral sits on Knob Hill, which is the highest hill in San Francisco. And, of course, being an Episcopal cathedral, that means it's the most expensive piece of real estate in the whole city of San Francisco. And for 100 years, the Episcopalians have had, up there on that top of the biggest hill in San Francisco, this massive neo-Gothic cathedral. It's the third largest one in North America.
And I was there not terribly long ago, just a few weeks ago, and I was talking to the dean, who is the minister in a cathedral in the Episcopal tradition. Her name is Jane. She comes from England. She has a PhD from Oxford in church history. Smart lady. And so I asked her, I said, Jane, you know, sort of how are things going here? And she said, well, Sunday attendance is way down. You know, they do amazing liturgy in this place. Mm-hmm. And beautiful music and the big choirs and the vests and, you know, the whole deal. She said, well, Sunday attendance is way down. And I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Any other things happening? You know, what else are sort of signs of liveliness around the cathedral? She said, well, last night there were 450 people in the nave. And I said, for what? She said, yoga class.
Well.
And so, you know, they can't get the people in the pews for Eucharist Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, but 450 people came to yoga class. And she said, have you seen our art exhibit upstairs yet? And I said, no, I haven't. And so she took me up, and this is what was upstairs. Grace is the first cathedral in the United States to take that labyrinth pattern I just showed you on that other church. Mm-hmm. This is where it started, pulling this chart cathedral labyrinth pattern over to the United States, and Grace was the first church to do this in the U.S. So they've had this labyrinth here for quite a while, and it's been a real point of sort of renewal, spiritual renewal in their congregation. People walk it all the time. This piece up here, it's the 100th anniversary of the cathedral. Mm-hmm. And so they commissioned an artist to conceptualize and execute a piece of art that would remind people that the building is a spiritual space, mm-hmm. that it is actually sacred space and that it's alive, that it's not just a pile of very expensive bricks with leaky roof. Mm-hmm. And so this is what the artist came up with. Mm-hmm. These things here are ribbons. Mm-hmm. It's 30,000 ribbons that are hanging from right here, the entryway, and then all the way down the nave towards the high altar. Mm-hmm. And you can see right here at the beginning of this long wall above the labyrinth, most of them that are focused here are red and purple. And then they progressively become blue and then a very deep purple when you get over the high altar. Now, they aren't just ribbons, but before they put them up, they laid out huge stretches of these ribbons, both in the cathedral and out on the streets around the cathedral. And they asked people in the congregation and in their neighborhood to write their prayers and dreams and hopes and fears on these ribbons. Mm-hmm. And so a huge number of these ribbons is covered with names of people, with prayers for health, with the things that folks want to do with their lives, their dreams for their children, all this stuff. And when they gathered up all the ribbons that were written on, the group of the art guild at the cathedral got into the cathedral and then hung these all up under the direction of the artist. And when you open, the great doors are down here. When the great doors are open, I was flabbergasted by this whole thing. The breeze hits that hill in San Francisco off of the bay, and those ribbons flutter towards the altar with the sunlight falling from the stained glass windows from both sides. And it is literally a vision of the New Testament talking about living stones.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so here's a church with some amazing resources and a great imagination trying to figure out what does it mean to put together spiritual and religious. How can we communicate to our neighborhood that we're more than just an expensive piece of real estate and, like I said, a lot of bricks? We're not just an institution, that we're something else. And so they communicated that in this art exhibit. And it's beautiful. Now, how these things result in church attendance or the number of people around them who might become Christians, that's all up for the future to tell us. But what it does communicate is that they're trying.
They're trying to be a different kind of community that is conceptualizing the life of faith in ways that are more accessible and more fluid and more generous and generative to the neighborhood. So those are things that, you know, if I came to class, I'd show you that slide. I also show you this. I love this slide. I just took this one not very long ago. That's the Detroit Airport. That used to be a chapel.
And I thought to myself, isn't that just fascinating, is that the language does not connect anymore, chapel. And so some committee sat around and said, well, what can we call a room where people sit around and talk to a chaplain about whether or not they're worried about getting on their plane? Let's call it a religious reflections room. So I put that up on Facebook, and the first thing, guess what my friend said? Why isn't it called a spiritual reflections room?
Right. That's the next thing.
I said, that's the next committee. Right. They'll come in and they'll fix it. And isn't that great? Yeah. It's just a sign of the time, the way things are changing.
Thank you so much, Diana.
Oh, thank you.
For your contributions. It's so amazing to have all of you, all of us in the room together. I'm sharing this in for Diana for helping us learn and process and talk together. So thanks to all of you for your afternoon.